Hello, I'm Eric Corman, Communications Director at League of Education Voters. Catherine Reynolds Lewis is an award-winning journalist based in the Washington, D.C. area who regularly writes for The Atlantic, Fortune, USA Today's magazines, Washington Post, and Working Mother. She's an EWA Education Reporting Fellow and Logan Nonfiction Fellow at the Carey Institute for Global Good. Her story about school discipline was Mother Jones's most read article ever, and she is a certified parent educator with the Parent Encouragement Program. Catherine's new book is The Good News About Bad Behavior, Why Kids Are Less Disciplined Than Ever, and What to Do About It. Follow her on Twitter at Catherine Lewis. Catherine, you say something very provocative at the beginning of your book, which is we should be asking ourselves as parents and as society, not why don't kids do what we want them to do, but why can't kids do what we want them to do? Why can't they do what we want them to do?
That is the sort of central question of the book and what the conclusion I came to when I started out reporting the book. I thought I was going to figure out why kids were so defiant, why they were so badly behaved, why they were choosing to disappoint us and annoy us and be so difficult. And over the course of 5 years of reporting and interviewing dozens, if not hundreds, of parents and educators and looking through all the research, I had to conclude that kids just didn't have the skills in almost every situation to do what was needed. Or what was desired, I should say, by the adult in charge, whether that's in a school setting or in homes. You know, the little annoyances that disrupt our days most of the time are because the kids just aren't there yet in terms of self-control or emotion management or executive function.
You mean they're not choosing to willfully disobey us?
Right. I mean, it seems like it. Certainly the heat that rises up in us when a kid is defiant is really powerful. But even when the child is sort of seems like they're just doing it to be difficult, often it's masking something else that's going on. And if we solve that problem, then suddenly the defiance goes away.
So it seems like there is this epidemic of kids not behaving the way that they did, say, a generation ago, or, you know, heavens, you know, two generations ago. I have a 9-year-old son, and we're constantly getting comments from other parents saying, oh, you need to spank him, or you need to, you know, not be so helicopter-y. And I look around and I see other kids that are doing the exact same thing that he is. I'm wondering how widespread is this? It can't possibly just be my kid.
Right. Well, one of the studies that my book really hangs on is from the National Institutes of Mental Health, finding that 1 in 2 children will have a mood or behavioral disorder or a substance addiction by the time they're 18. So this is beyond just sort of saying no when you ask them to eat their peas. It's kids are sort of on the far end of a spectrum that includes other behavior that's really difficult. To me, even though it's a shocking statistic, I hope it's also normalizing that if you're having trouble in your home, I'm having trouble in mine, our neighbor is having trouble. They may be slightly different varieties of what exactly is going on, but we're all working in an environment where kids don't just fall into lockstep when adults snap their fingers. And so we need to find other solutions to getting done what's needed, to getting through the day smoothly, to helping our children accomplish what they need to accomplish.
Well, you say that there's some reasons for this, that child rearing today is different than it used to be. How is it different?
Well, there's 3 big factors that have changed in the last 20, 30 years that are all associated with higher rates of anxiety, depression, and attention issues. And that is 1, the disappearance of childhood play. Mm. 2, the growth of media and technology and just how it permeates everything. And 3, how kids are really unemployed. They don't have household jobs. They don't have a role in the community or neighborhood or family where they're relied on. They don't have after school jobs, certainly. And instead, what they're doing in many of our communities is very high stress, high level things like achieving in academics, becoming the sports star, excelling at arts and music, which are wonderful. But if they're the only foundation of your child's identity, then that's kind of hollow. If they have a sports injury, suddenly, who are they if they're not the soccer star? So when they are doing little things or big things that contribute to their family, to the community, where they can see the impact of their efforts and how it helps another person, that is a much more solid foundation to build an identity and sense of self-worth on.
Yeah, I see my own son, for example, and he's bringing home a test the other day. He's in third grade, as I said, and he was doing geometry in third grade, finding the area of a triangle that has different sized sides. I'm looking at this going, my God, I didn't do this kind of work until I was in seventh or maybe eighth grade, and now he's doing it in third. And then there's so many distractions. You mentioned the social media. And school is just, in general, a lot harder than it used to be because there's more kids with similar issues like what he's got. How do you manage that stress without wanting to pile stuff on top of it? Because that's what I worry about. I have relatives, for example, that had kids, and they're like, oh, we don't want them to worry about anything other than doing well in school because they'll get too stressed out. And I worry about the same thing for my own son.
Right. Well, truly, every child whose parents are listening to your show or who's reading my book, they're going to get an opportunity to go to college. Kids in communities where the parents care enough end up going to college. They may not go to Stanford, you know, they may not go to the one school you have your heart set on, but kids who are raised by caring, educated parents who give them the resources they need to succeed will do fine even without all that extra after-school tutoring or geometry class in third grade. And when we put on the pressure, what it does to our kids is sends them the message that their achievements are so high stakes. And that causes them to seize up in fear. And I don't think it's a coincidence that of those disorders I mentioned, anxiety is the highest. 32% of kids have anxiety. We parents are contributing to that. I won't say we're the only cause because it's a very fearful culture, right? Mm-hmm. But the more that we can help them to understand what are their goals, how do they want to succeed, what are our family goals, and make it more balanced, it'll give them the sense that it's not a race to 18 with the college acceptance being the prize, right? Yep. They need to succeed as adults. So they're going to make mistakes along the way. And even if one of those mistakes is a C or a D or an F, they'll figure out how to overcome that. Because if you can't fail as a third grader, you know, you're never going to be able to learn how to fail and get back up.
So let's unpack that a little bit. What can that look like, this sort of scaffolding and helping your child?
I have a 14-year-old.
Okay. So you're 14. You know, so I know the stakes are a little bit higher when you're 14 than they are when you're 9. But how do you engage a child who is 14 or 9 in a conversation about family goals?
Well, we have weekly family meetings, and we try to have at the beginning of every season, what are our activities that we're going to do? What are your goals in school? What are your goals for recreational time? So that we all make commitments and we see them through. And if you maybe sign up for a soccer team and it's 8 weeks and you get tired of it 3 weeks in, you finish the season. And similarly, if you say your goals are to get 4 A's and a B, and then you're not bringing home those grades, we have a conversation about what you can do to reach your own goals. When our kids are babies, we're 100% responsible for everything. When they are 18 or 25 and they're independent, we're responsible for zero. So we have to somehow get on that glide path. We have to shrink our responsibility constantly, hand over more to them. And sometimes we'll overestimate, we'll hand over too much, and then we need to take back a little bit. It's a little bit of a dance, a flexible figuring out where they are and how they can be challenged more and where they do need support. So you asked what it looks like in third grade. It really depends on your own son. But I would start with saying to him, what do you really love to do? What are your goals? And I think you might be surprised by how much he's thought about it.
He is a thinker, definitely. Would you mind if I ask your child a question?
Go right ahead.
All right, child who will remain nameless. How do you feel about this process? I assume you're doing it at home, about being part of family decisions. Do you feel like you have the right amount of responsibility, or is it too much or too little?
I have to say, I think it's probably, it's perfect because it really, it can fit anyone. We have family meetings, like my mom said. We have to sign papers that say what our sports are going to be. So I had to commit to like one season of soccer. And if I didn't fulfill my commitment, then I wouldn't get the choice next time. I wouldn't get to do soccer again because it was a waste of money. It was like I had to stick to my commitments. And there wasn't really a question. But if I put up enough of a fight, I just wouldn't get to do it again.
So did the idea of signing a contract, did that make it more real, or did it make it easier to fulfill your commitment?
I think it just pretty much made it more fun. Like signing a piece of paper is fun. And I think it made me feel like I was
more adult, maybe?
Yeah.
Is there anything that you would change about the process?
I think in the end, even if like during the process I don't love it, in the end it always comes out with a good ending. I always enjoy the commitments that I make, even if I don't want to go to them.
And how do you feel when the term of the contract is over, like when you've actually completed the thing that you said you were going to do?
I mean, it feels great. It feels like you made a commitment, you saw it through. I went through something like 5 years of Hebrew school, and every time I went to Hebrew school, I really hated it.
So did
but,
I.
but now that I'm done with it, I really see the benefits, and I understand why my mom and dad refused to let me skip more than two every season.
That's fantastic.
And I understand why I'm going to, when I have kids, force them to go to Hebrew school too.
That's great. Thank you, child. So this can work, I can see, for families who have neurotypical kids. But what about if you have a kid who's on the spectrum or has some special needs?
Right.
How would you modify this to accommodate them?
For the most part, it really doesn't have to be modified much. It may take longer. So a kid who has ADHD may not learn after one or two times forgetting their coat and then being cold or leaving their homework at school. They may need to forget 20 times, but eventually they are capable of learning. And kids who are atypical still have the ability to learn, unless they have a diagnosis where that's really a challenge. So it may mean different strategies, different scaffolding, more patience, which is often the case with any child who has special needs. But I've found that when you challenge kids, they rise to the occasion. And it was so interesting hearing my own child just explain that it felt adult, because I actually think that's part of what works with this discipline model, is that we are treating children with respect and expecting a lot of them. And so they appreciate that they're being given real life household chores. They are being asked to keep their commitments and treated like adults, or not exactly like, but given those kind of adult responsibilities. So you might find that your kids surprise you if you give them a little something a little harder than you think they can handle.
So what can this look like in a classroom, say? Like if I'm a teacher, what should I do?
Well, the three foundational elements of all the discipline models I wrote about in my book are connection between an adult and child, communication about the behavior or issue at hand, and capability building. And that's this focus on skills, social, emotional, life skills, household jobs, or classroom jobs. So in a classroom, at the beginning of the year, the teacher might have a group discussion saying, what do we all care about? How do we want to behave towards each other? What should our classroom rules be? And agree on them. The kids can write them out, put them on the wall. One of the principals I interviewed for my book says, we have signs and rubrics on the walls for letters, for math facts, and geography. Why not have something on the wall that reminds kids about behavior expectations? And in this case, they've helped create those rules. So they have a buy-in. They're much more likely to follow through if they have that connection with the adult, they're being treated with some respect, and they have a way to communicate, what do I want to feel, do, hear, see in this classroom? They find that that's really effective. The other important thing in classrooms that are overcrowded and understaffed is the teachers help the children develop their own strategies to self-regulate. So that may mean a tub of little soft toys that the kids can take if they feel stressed. It may mean three passes a day to walk out and get a drink of water if you need a movement break. All kinds of different ways that children can have more responsibility for managing their behavior and emotions, so the teacher isn't trying to negotiate with every single child in that classroom every time they need something or feel stressed or overloaded.
Have you seen pushback about this?
In classrooms?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it sounds fantastic.
Yeah.
But what are the barriers of making this happen in every classroom?
The real barrier is the adult's mentality. We have this mentality that we need to be in control and in charge. We just have that need for power. When the adults start to realize that the more you give over to the kids, the more they'll step up, then the whole framework shifts. There's a lot more cooperation. So I find the pushback is usually in the theoretical, this can't work. And when people start to see it in action and they see children in high trauma, high poverty, high need schools kind of running the show and cooperating with the adults, they start to say, oh, wow, how can we do that in our school?
Got it. So it's really just airing the bright spots, like spotlighting this school is doing this and these are the results that it's getting. And hopefully that will be enough to change the mindset of the adults.
Well, I think that the trauma-informed training that the adults in the schools that I've looked at really, really helps because it gives them a scientific foundation to understand when kids are triggered by a loud noise or by someone brushing against them, that it may not be personal. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's most likely because their fight or flight alarm has been triggered and it's not anything to do with a conscious choice. And that helps to bring in this new mindset that it's not a choice to behave badly. It's actually just a physiological thing going on in the kid's body. And once we give them tools to manage that, or even just to start identifying when it's happening, we can see less and less behavior problems over time.
I've been told that we are sort of in the dark ages when it comes to social emotional learning. Like, you know, the way that we see that today is how medicine used to be when we were leeching. Do you think that years from now, emotional regulation and knowing how to engage kids on an emotional level is going to look completely different than the way we see it now?
I certainly think there will be an understanding that that is just as important to teach in schools as reading, writing, and arithmetic. That unless kids can sit in the seats and focus and manage their own thoughts, they're not going to learn any of that good stuff. So it's just as important and should be elevated to a priority in schools at the same level. So yes, I think in the future, we'll look back and say, oh, these schools who were doing restorative justice, who were using trauma-informed care, who were having self-regulation stations and the PACS Good Behavior Game and collaborative and proactive solutions and some of the other models that I've written about and others that I haven't that are out there, they were the leaders and they really were ahead of the curve.
Going back to parenting, and I guess teachers could use this too, if a child is acting out, how do you find out what's behind it?
Three steps, that same three-step model I talked about before, connection first, right? You put a gentle hand on their forearm, you find a way to connect with an interest so that you have that bond and that empathy actually helps their brain self-regulate. Number two, communicate, which means you share what's concerning you about it and you draw out from that child what might have been going on for them. And that can take a lot of patience. You know, talking to a third grader, yes, you don't always get a great explanation the first time, but you can just be patient and stay with the child and say things like, I notice when you transition to lunch, it seems like it's hard, and sometimes it's hard to keep your hands to yourself. What's up with that? Can you tell me more about that? And persist. If they kind of squirm, say, looks like this might be a hard topic. Can you take a guess at what might be going on? Because you know better than I do what might be causing what's happening for you. And then the third is that capability building, where you help to serve as the memory keeper for the child. They may not see how their behavior is improving. So you can say to them, oh my gosh, 2 months ago, you left your workbook at school and you didn't remember until you were about to fall asleep. This time, you remembered halfway home. Boy, that's improvement.
Child of Catherine, did this approach work for you? I mean, do you remember the last time that your mom had to put a hand on your shoulder and try to find that connection to understand what it was that was going on?
I do. Probably just last week. I graduated and I was having some mixed emotions about leaving school, and I was being slightly, not hostile, but kind of removed, not exactly as emotionally together with the family as I usually am. And so mom kind of walked over and was like, hey, what's going on? And it definitely helped. It's actually, the way that she was describing it kind of reminded me of potty training, where, you know, you teach the kid to recognize that they're about to pee. And then after they recognize that they're about to pee, then you teach them how to run to the bathroom before they pee. And then you teach them how to, like, do other stuff related to using the bathroom.
So what did you do differently after she talked to you?
After she talked to me, I apologized to the family for being slightly distant. And it gave me a different look about how it's okay to open up to your family about being sad about leaving somewhere or being sad about a change in your life. And I think that's a really great part of her model of discipline. I think that's what you call it in your book. I think that's something that is different.
And how did you feel afterwards?
It's like kind of like a weight lifted off your shoulders when you're able to share something.
Catherine Lewis's new book is The Good News About Bad Behavior: Why Kids Are Less Disciplined Than Ever and What to Do About It. Follow her on Twitter at Catherine Lewis. Catherine, child of Catherine, thank you so much for coming in.
My pleasure. It's been so much fun.
Thank you.